The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our Sunday Space Show game. That's because I have the San Francisco Giants game on in the background. Excuse me for that. It's now turned off to the Sunday Space Show program. And it is great to be here. It's a gorgeous day in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice as what we have going on right now in the Bay Area. We have a great show for you today. It's going to be a lot of fun. It is going to be informative, and we're going to push the edge of what's plausible in certain areas, and we have an outstanding guest to do that with us in his book, which I will talk about in a minute, is an exceptional read to take us into the realm that I just described. But in the meantime, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223, and you're welcome to give us a call. Remember, there are no call screeners. Just let the phone ring. I'll answer it and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. I'll hold you over during breaks, and I will also answer the phone during breaks. And if you still prefer our email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do also remember that we do podcasting, and you can find our podcast in quite a few places. Plus, the RSS URL is on our website and both of our newsletters, the short form as well as the website form. Check us out on iTunes, Podcast Alley, AstroSpaceNow.com, YAstro.com, and Microsoft's Zoom. And we're in other places as well. And if you have any recommendations or suggestions or comments, do let me hear from you at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then also remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, but you can download our programs. They're compressed MP3s. A 90-minute show is roughly 40 megabytes. And you are free to distribute these programs any way that you can, but please don't do anything commercial. No edits with the program's private YouTube channels or anything of that nature. And remember, written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And our website is thespaceshow.com, so by Sunday evening, our comprehensive, detailed newsletter is posted on the website. It has all of the guest bios, the coming events for the future for the Space Show, and the full details of the week's programming. And then if we have to make any quick announcements or change our schedule, you're going to find it first on the website newsletter. So do check it from time to time to stay current. You can't miss it. Big, big letters in the upper quarter of our spaceshow.com website. Everything we do is archived, and you can pick up all of our shows and listen off of our website or easily download them, going back, of course, to 2001. There is a store on our website. You'll see it up near the top, Space Show Gear. And then above all, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with One Giant Leap Foundation. org, and this program only exists because many of you do financially support the program, and we appreciate that very much. Remember, if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a deduction. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. If you're paying California taxes, the same thing. I really don't know what happens with the deductions at the state level in other states. If any of you want to share that information with me, I'll be happy to put it out over the air. And then do remember also that the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, please visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And that brings me to our guest today, and Les Johnson is back with us. He's a physicist, and he has co-authored several science fiction books and authored them. He is also the deputy manager of NASA's Advanced Concept Office at Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama. His bio is extensive. It is on the website, and so you can read it. But we're going to be talking about his new book, which he is co-editor of. The book is called Going Interstellar, Build Starships Now, and it's edited by Les as well as Jack McDivitt, and it's published by Bain, B-A-E-N. And this is a series of stories by noted sci-fi authors as well as legitimate scientists on how we might do interstellar travel and what that might look like. And the stories are great. The science and the engineering is plausible. And if you're interested in going interstellar, this might be the book and the set of stories and the set of articles for you to read. So rather than talk about our guest, Les, let's bring him on board. And by the way, I got to meet him in person finally. He was at the hotel where I was staying in Melbourne when I was there for the ISU Space and Media panel, and he was sitting with Leonard David over breakfast and coffee, and when I went up, he introduced himself to me, and it was great to put a face with a guest who's been on the show probably four times. I think this is your fourth time, Les. So welcome back to the Space Show. It was a pleasure meeting you in person in Florida.
Well, thanks, David. I appreciate the kind words. I, you know, you said you didn't want to talk about my book anymore. You were saying such good things. I was perfectly content to sit back and let you keep going.
No, you're going to talk about your book, not me.
Hey, I have to give a quick caveat. I do work for NASA, but I write these books on my own time as a personal hobby and activity and kind of passion that I have. And so I have to let people know that any views I express on here are not the views to represent NASA. They are purely my own. So similar to the caveat you had to give at the beginning of your show, I have to let people know that before I start talking. So
yeah, well, many people would be surprised if NASA actually had a policy or program to think interstellar. So actually, when you do advanced propulsion, do you seriously for a minute on your NASA side, when you're working in advanced propulsion and science and things like that, do you guys really think about interstellar, or is it just so far out there that it doesn't get any real attention?
It comes up more often than you'd think. In fact, how I got interested in interstellar travel professionally, as opposed to just being a science fiction fan, which I've been all my life, is back, 12, 13 years ago, very briefly, NASA had a interstellar propulsion technology project, which I managed. And that's how I got interested in some of the technologies that might eventually take us to the stars. So NASA has flirted with that over the years, and, you know, in and out of favor in terms of where research dollars go. But I would say that a lot of people I work with, although it's not the current goal of the agency, a lot of us are real space cadets, and we're hoping that some of the things that we work on today, you know, might be in the future genealogy of the system that does take us to the stars. So, yeah, it comes up, but not usually in the professional setting. It's usually over lunch or just in some side conversation.
So there's no congressional funding to an interstellar program?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Maybe
darn
it's
it.
Maybe it's a black project and we just don't know about it. What do you think?
Well, I mean, there is this 100-year starship activity that's through DARPA, right?
Right.
And their goal is to kind of do that, to be thinking and laying the groundwork now for maybe in 100 years doing something like that. So it's not really that there isn't funding. It's just it's not a sustained focus of anybody in the government over the long term.
So you edited the book with Jack McDivitt. He's your co-editor, correct? Who's a noted sci-fi writer, former teacher. And you have articles, or I guess short stories would be a better way of describing it, from very well-known and famous sci-fi authors. And then you also have plausible science articles on what Interstellar would look like from a group of scientists. Is that a fair assessment? They're intermixed in the book.
That's right. And the book, it came about kind of in an odd way. The goal was to try to take the idea of going to the stars and get it out there so that people could know that within modern views of the understanding of physics and things, that it's not something that's impossible, but merely really, really, really hard. And I think there's a sense of frustration among fans of deep space travel because science fiction has made it look so easy to hop in your faster-than-light ship and careen around the galaxy. And as much fun as that is, it doesn't look like nature's allowed us the loopholes to go do that. And what we wanted to do in this book is get some really good writers and let's tell some engaging stories about what it might really be like if you're limited to not faster than light travel. And so that's how we got the idea rolling with Bayon. And getting the authors was actually kind of easy. I asked Jack, who I had met at some science fiction conventions. I give science talks at science fiction conventions, and he and I had had several conversations, and I was kind of a technical consultant on a couple of his books. I said, Jack, you know, you've got the science fiction connections. I don't. Let's put together a joint proposal and see if we can and can get interest in Bayon to go do this book, and they bought it right away. So that's when we went out and started recruiting the writers and some of the essays that are in there. So it's a mix. It's mostly science fiction, original stories. None of these have been printed before. And intermixed with those stories are some essays written by myself, Greg Matloff, who I've written other popular science books with before, Richard Obese of the 100-Year Starship and Icarus Interstellar, that kind of tell the story behind the story as far as the technologies go.
You know, absolutely. You have three different, categories. I can't believe the phone's already ringing. We'll hold them for a minute. You have basically three sort of different kinds of vehicles that are talked about to be able to pull this off. You've got like a sleeper vehicle, and I guess that'd be hibernation, right? And a generation type of starship that people wrote about, where the people who go initially are not going to be the ones that get there. It's going to be, you know, younger people who are, I guess, come about on the way. And then you've, you know, got solar sails. And what do you think is the most plausible if we're really going to be able to develop this? What is likely to evolve initially for Interstellar?
That's a tough question because, you know, it's so far out and we can have so many breakthroughs. I personally think for robotic missions, if someone were to say, let's make a bet for, you know, 200 years from now, which technology is going to be the first to send a robotic probe to the Alpha Centauri system, Proxima Centauri and all that, I would probably go with a solar sail or a laser-beamed energy sail for a robotic craft. If we're talking about sending people or big payloads, I would extend the time frame out beyond that, and I would put my bets on fusion.
Okay, but, you know, we've got a couple of, probes that we have sent out decades ago that have finally left our solar system. Right?
Well, that's right, and I guess that comes to how you define interstellar, right? I mean, there's the region, technically, interstellar space begins where the region of influence from the sun, our sun, is kind of balanced by the influence of the rest of the stars in the Milky Way. And that region is usually defined out near what they call the heliopause, helio for sun, pause for the edge of it. And the Voyager spacecraft may have actually crossed over and now be out into interstellar space at over 120, something like that, astronomical units out. And so technically, if that's true, we technically are already an interstellar species.
Well, yeah, but look how long it took, and we're still not any place, you know, we're not any place close to Alpha Centauri or anything.
Oh, no. At the rate Voyager's going, if it were pointed in the right direction, it would be 74,000 years before it were to get there.
So we got to do better.
Interstellar is kind of one of those terms you got to be careful. If you're talking about going to another star, that's right now in the realm of science fiction. Not fantasy, because there is some science that says we can do it. We just don't know how to engineer it. Faster-than-light drive falls into the category of, based on what we currently know, it's fantasy, but it's a fun read. But the Voyager and all that is taking that first step, and if it were me, I would lay out an incremental plan where we go further and further into interstellar space and just map out the neighborhood as we go and perfect the technologies and make them better with each generation of ship. Before we actually attempt something really bad.
Well, we got to do a lot better than 74,000 years.
Yeah, you're right.
Let's see who your caller is already. Hi, caller. You're on the space show. Who are you?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. This is Jack from Virginia.
Hi, Jack. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Hanging in there. Yeah.
Just wanted to ask Les if he'd be willing to paint a picture for us of funding, how the challenges of funding offices like the Advanced Concepts Office at Marshall, and where he thinks funding for the kind of work they do is going to go, given this impending mass extinction event that we refer to as sequestration.
I like mass extinction event a lot better. I haven't heard that one before, Jack. I may adopt it for future space show programs.
hopefully it won't.
So how do you see the mass extinction program, Les?
I have to be real careful here because I really can't, not speaking with my NASA hat on, talking about budget stuff is hard to do because we don't have, you know, we're totally at the mercy of the powers that be in Washington for how that goes. But the Advanced Concepts Office, we look at a lot nearer term stuff than interstellar travel. I don't want listeners to think that we're out dreaming just about stuff like that because that's really not what we do. In my office, we're asked to do what are called concept studies and pre-mission studies to determine if things that are in the very near term are actually feasible, what they might look like, and if they're doable. So we might get a scientist come in and says, I want to do this telescope mission or this science instrument that's going to study whatever in space. And we have a team of engineers, about 30 engineers, that will work to design a spacecraft around that. And we'll estimate how big it is, how much it'll weigh, how much power it'll require, are the technologies here to build it today or not? And if the answer is not, what do we need to be able to support it in the future? And then we work with cost analysts to come up with how much it'll cost. And then that's handed to the powers that be to decide whether or not that's actually going to go somewhere. So the advanced concepts that are 99.9% of what we work on are advanced in the sense that they aren't flying today, but they're not the kind of stuff that I'm talking about in my writing. That's purely outside of NASA at this point. Getting back to the question at hand about the sequestration, I mean, that's a big unknown. We don't know what the impact of that's going to be. And obviously, if there's this huge budget cut, starting new missions is going to be difficult, and that will have a ripple effect down on us because if no one's able or very few people are able to talk about new missions, and obviously, you know, the work that we do would be impacted by that. And that's really all I can say. I know that's not the answer you're probably wanting to hear. You're wanting to get more specific, but I really don't know what's
going
to happen.
Are you planning around sequestration, or you're just going along as normal, and whatever happens by the powers that be, you just go along like the rest of we Americans?
The latter. we haven't. I personally, at my level in the management, have not received any instructions to do any planning whatsoever for those conditions.
Well, maybe the bozos will come to some agreement before it happens.
I hope so. I hope so, because I think there are a lot of unintended consequences that will come out of things like that. And some may not be unintended, I guess. But I'm an optimist. I think that space is a vital part of America's economy now, and that's a whole topic for another show, and that we can't afford to ignore space in any way, shape, or form today. I really believe that as a country, we would be making a huge mistake
I mean,
if we did that.
Your space show audience certainly supports that. I mean, we, you know, are big believers in that, regardless of whether we like this or that program better or this or that rocket, you know, or James Webb or something. But, it's way beyond the responsibility of the space community here. What else, Jack?
Well, Les mentioned some of the nearer-term projects that the Advanced Concepts Office is working on, and they specifically mentioned that they have a cost analysis of these projects. And I'm curious to know how many folks do you have that are involved in actually analyzing the cost of these missions, and as opposed to the engineers that are actually designing them? Is this and how is that done? How do you determine how much these missions are going to cost, whether or not they'll be cost-effective?
Well, not being a cost analyst myself, being a physicist, we interact with the group. It's a separate office, the Advanced Concepts Office. We don't do the cost analysis. There's a separate group of experts who do that. But they have a huge database of missions that have flown, both mostly government-funded, not just NASA-funded, but government-funded missions. And when they're doing an estimate for what a new mission is going to be, they have a database and some very specific questions and inputs that go into that, which compare the requirements of this new project with ones that have gone before. So so you can actually benchmark it against one that's gone before. Let me give an example. If you need a certain size solar array to operate in Earth orbit, we've got a whole bunch of spacecraft in space now that use various size solar arrays to generate a certain amount of power, and they're in Earth orbit. So for that subsystem, they would go look and say, okay, what does it cost to go buy one of those, which is an off-the-shelf component, and that would be something that would go in the cost estimate. If it's something new that's never been done before, which, of course, people like me get excited about, but that's where you have a big uncertainty in what the cost is going to be, and then there you have to make more educated guesses based on similar systems or what you know about it and where its development is and kind of what you think it'll take to get it to the next level. So it's a mixture of flight data, what things really did cost, combined with some kind of expert judgment. But the experts in that are not me. I'm not a cost modeler and I'm not a cost analyst, but I do work with them and I have to provide inputs to them as they do their work. And it's not a lot of people. These databases have been built. The biggest effort, I think, was probably in building the database and keeping it up to date. It only takes a few people to be able to know how to use it and give you those estimates.
Well, thank you very much. That answered my question.
Thank you, Jack. Listeners, our line is available, 1-866-687-7223. This is Perry, who is in Dallas, Texas. And Perry says, sci-fi authors love to talk about faster-than-light travel and wormholes, among other things. In your opinion, thinking about science fiction and how these items are described, are they physically plausible? Are we at all close to being able to figure them out? What would it take to really develop faster-than-light travel or to be able to use a wormhole?
Wow. By the way, I am a physicist, but just because I'm a physicist doesn't make me an expert in all areas of advanced physics, because it's very specialized, and there are a lot of people who focus on dark matter or high-energy astrophysics that will know the nuances of this better than I do. But within my understanding of the current laws of physics, the way nature works as we currently understand it, we're not going to be able to go faster than light. There have been some hypothetical constructs out there to talk about making a wormhole, and it involves negative mass, the size of planets, and all these things. And as far as I'm concerned, that's great theoretical analysis, but nature hasn't given us any evidence that this is real yet. And so, unfortunately, I hate to dash listeners' hopes, but unless we have some dramatic change in our understanding of the way nature works, I think faster-than-light travel will be flat-out impossible. Now, I had to give that caveat, because when a scientist says something's impossible, they've been proved wrong a lot. It could be that our understanding of nature is flawed, and someone will have a breakthrough that will fundamentally change everything, and the next thing you know, we've got the Enterprise, and I hope that's the case. But when I look out at what we currently know about the way the universe works, I don't see a way to get there from here.
Okay, so let me stop you for a minute, and I'll just play devil's advocate, because I read all of this in the sci-fi, and I love it as much as the next guy, and, you know, wish that it had materialized while I was young enough to take advantage of it rather than as a senior citizen. But we just think or are pretty sure that Higgs boson was just confirmed, right?
Right.
A year ago, that was still a search. You know, and 5 years ago, about when CERN was brought online, it was really out there theoretically. So, and with discovering Higgs boson, I think they said they discovered more particles or an additional particle or something that they didn't even know existed. And, of course, the idea to figure out what all this means for physics and humans and mass, I mean, nobody knows, okay? I mean, it's just at the forefront of being able to realize that it's very, very likely to exist. So that may change our fundamental understanding of at least part of physics and the laws of physics, whether it will go so far as to influence something like faster-than-light travel. I'm not qualified to talk about that for sure. But things do get discovered, and people do propose theories all the time. So how likely is it that over 20 or 30 or 40 years, our understanding may change that would allow faster than light travel. Is that just so minimum in terms of what really happens and fundamental changes? Are changes basically just an incremental step, or could there be a change that is just like light years from everything else that we've known?
Well, and that's why I want to be real careful in the caveat that I give here when I say these things, because I always try to say within what we currently know about the way nature works. Because you're absolutely right in that someone could make an observation, a measurement, discover something that allows us to do something that we currently think is impossible. And you can't rule that out.
But how likely is it?
Yeah, you can't count on it either.
So
it seems to me to be very, very unlikely. And the reason I say that is because when we look around with our telescopes and we look in the laboratory and we look at everything from the incredibly large to the very, very small, it sure looks like that we don't see anything violating nature's speed limit.
Well, then what about finding Higgs boson and the day before finding that?
Well, the difference, as I understand it, and I'm not a high-energy particle physicist, is that the existence of the Higgs boson was predicted, and it was predicted to be at the energy levels and under certain conditions that they actually used to find it, and that it was a part of a model to explain the way the universe works that it is actually explaining the way things work. It's not going to change our understanding of the way the universe works. It was part of a theory that said, you know, this seems to work, this model seems to predict accurately how nature works, but there's one fundamental particle we haven't found, but it seems to be there. It's got to be there. Because if it is, then this model works really, really well. I won't say perfectly. It works really, really well to explain things. And if it exists, you go look right here under these conditions. And so they did, and they think they found it. That's a very different thing than seeking to find something that there's no evidence that it exists. The Higgs boson, there was a tremendous amount of evidence that it ought to be there. And sure enough, when they were able to get the right conditions using the collider that they have over at CERN, they were able to find it. So it's sort of like on the periodic table. In fact, I was having a discussion this morning. You never know what happens at church. This was a discussion at church in Huntsville, Alabama, talking about these things on the coffee break. We were actually talking about the periodic table. And when the periodic table was first put together, you could see these regular patterns on each of the rows and columns, and there were some holes, some elements that ought to be there that were not known at the time the periodic table was being put together. And the chemists and the physicists said, well, look, you know, according to this, there ought to be an element that has this atomic number and have these characteristics. And sure enough, years later, they found it. They plugged it in the hole. That's a predictive thing of science, where nature behaves in a certain way and you say it ought to be there. We're really far afield of interstellar travel. Sorry about that. But I guess the bottom line is I haven't heard of, and that could be my ignorance, any analogous thing in nature where we have seen something moving faster than light and we need to go figure out how it's doing it. I haven't seen or heard anything about that. And I'm bummed. Because I really would like to see that happen.
Well, you know, the way you get out of being bummed is you give up your grounding in physics and you just take the Kool-Aid approach, or the New Age approach, that if you can imagine it, it must be real.
Well, yeah, but that won't get me very far engineering something.
It doesn't matter, because the people who do this don't engineer anything anyway.
Well, that's true.
So,
that's true.
You know, it's like human spaceflight is 100% safe when you don't fly.
That's true. Well, and I don't want to diss the people who are out there on the edge, because there are some really good scientists out there who are investigating the edge of what we understand about the universe, and they think that there may be some things that'll let us go faster than light down some theoretical path. The problem with that is they have yet to be able to verify it in the process of science and experiment. And some of these people may get lucky, and maybe it's there and they'll find it.
Well, what about wormholes and work by a lot of theoretical physicists and people that have really done amazing work about wormholes and all that? I mean, we don't have the energy to master it yet, but is that more plausible than faster than light travel?
It may be, but I really worry about this whole notion of causality and Einstein, because in wormholes, as I understand it, and again, I'm way far afield of my knowledge base here, is that that you get into questions of, you know, when you travel faster than light, then you have the potential to be able to communicate in the past, and then you get into all these time travel things, you know, the paradoxes that are there, and I have difficulty believing that nature works that way.
I wonder if I can go back in time and rig myself to win the $800 million Mega Million lottery from 2 months ago.
and things like that. And so when we put the book together, and when I give talks, and I do go out and talk to people about interstellar travel, is I like to couch it in the what's possible, because quite frankly, within the realm of what's possible, it's still darn exciting. Just because we may not be able to go faster than light doesn't mean we ought not go to the stars. And someday, you know, if you think beyond the scope of the next election cycle, and you think beyond the scope of our lifetime, and you think of the lifetime of a civilization, darn it, we ought to be able to do this. This is not impossible. We may not have the engineering today to do it, but with some of these technologies that we talk about in the book and that I like to think about, nature appears to have given us a path where we can go to the stars. It's just going to take time. And by time, I think we could build a robotic probe to another star within plausible, even if I don't know how to build it today, but I'll say plausible engineering, that would have a trip time of about 1,000 years versus 70,000 years. So, to me, that's a huge difference, because we have civilizations going back 1,000 years, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so if we start thinking beyond the immediate and we take this long-term view, we can do this. Will we do it? I don't know, but I think we should.
You have another caller, and I would love to see our money going into this rather than a lot of what it goes into. So let's see who's calling. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, yes. This is Jerry Everett from Merritt Island.
Hi, Jerry. How you doing?
Okay, how are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good.
By the way, I just had my first ever trip to Merritt Island. My wife, as a girl, grew up there. Her dad was one of the early NASA engineers, worked on Skylab, and she, as a girl, got to see Skylab launch. So we were down there for the ISU David mentioned, and I had my first ever trip to Merritt Island and went to see her neighborhood and had a great time. It's a beautiful area.
I love Merritt Island, and you're lucky. You've got a space family going there.
I sure do. I married into a NASA family when I moved here, so it's been great.
Very good. Well, Dr. Johnson, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was some of the work that's being done at Marshall, or was being done at Marshall, on fission. One of them was fission fragment rocket engine, which should be, you know, could give you velocities of 3 to 5% of the speed of light, which would give you a space probe, unmanned space probe, to some of our closer stars that would measure in as a century or two rather than thousands of years. And I know Marshall had done some work on that and had submitted a proposal to NASA for one of these $100,000 space technology grants. Where that's good, if you know anything about that. The other thing is, I understand that they're also doing assembling a second-hand Z-bench reactor there at Huntsville to look at thermonuclear rocket propulsion, and where that's good. So I just wanted to get your insights into those things.
Sure. The fission fragment rocket, I don't know a whole lot about that, but that was a NIAC award. NASA Advanced Concepts Office award went to the PI at Marshall. His name's Bob Werka. And our office actually did a system study about how you'd build a spacecraft around a fission fragment propulsion system. But that's about all I know about fission fragment. I haven't seen convincing numbers that it's going to let you get to 3 to 5% of the speed of light. I'll have to go investigate that. You give me one, I need to go back and look into. But I need to read the final report of that NIAC. And I know he's put in a proposal, at least I believe he put in a proposal, to try to get additional funds to keep working on that technology. So that would be a good thing. On the fission, you know, there are two ways that you can use the energy of a fission reaction, like we use in nuclear power plants to generate electricity to drive a rocket ship. And one way is to create electricity instead of solar arrays, go where the sun doesn't shine very much, like in the outer solar system, and drive some electric propulsion systems, some ion engines, which we know how to build, and you can do deep space exploration with that. Another way is to basically build a hotter rocket engine, which is what was done in the 60s with the NERVA program, the nuclear thermal rockets. And you're right, there's a group at Marshall working with the Glenn Research Center we're not doing any nuclear work at Marshall. We're looking at the systems you'd go around the reactor so that you could actually make a nuclear thermal rocket engine. And that's the kind of thing that we need, in my opinion, if we're going to really be sending people around the solar system. That kind of a propulsion system is a high thrust, high efficiency compared to chemical, but it's absolutely what we need to send people throughout the solar system. It doesn't have the energy density you need to go to the stars. But that's okay. I'm happy with having a more efficient way to move people around in the near term. So you're right, there is work in both of those areas happening here. Dr. Houts is one of the key people working on the nuclear thermal propulsion here at Marshall, and he might be a good guest for your show sometime, David. He's very knowledgeable about that.
What's his name?
Mike Houts, H-O-U-T-S.
I've done quite a bit of programming on the nuclear thermal rocket with a variety of people, and they all talk about going down to Marshall and doing tests and working with Marshall on it. So I'm really interested, and I think we should have obviously had it a long time ago, but I guess we'll be lucky if we have it at all.
What's frustrating about nuclear propulsion and the whole fission rockets is you would think that, you know, that's really energetic, and you'd think it'd be perfect for some of the early interstellar missions.
Uh-huh.
But even it doesn't have enough energy that it can carry on board to efficiently go to the stars. And that's why the fission fragment might be a better way to get more energy out of it, but everything I've seen is that even if it did, it would only be good for the nearest stars, and if you wanted to go further, you'd have to make that step up to fusion and maybe ultimately antimatter propulsion.
Can you, after the show, put me in touch with him?
Sure, I'll be glad to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jerry, what else?
Well, just that Dr. Brofsky did a presentation at FISO here recently on June 27th. Very nice presentation on the use of the old 1960s nuclear thermal reactor or rocket engine, the Pee-wee engine, specifically, on how that could, how you could build with current technology a viable deep space, primitive deep space. Spaceship, which is, in my opinion, what NASA should be building, not rockets. In any case, if you get a chance, if you could log on to FISO and get the his presentation, that would, I think, that'd be terrific. I don't, Dr. Stanley Brofsky.
I know Stan. I've worked with him before. He is probably one of the best advocates that we could have out anywhere talking about the benefits of nuclear thermal propulsion.
What is his last name again, guys?
It's Borowski, B-R-O-O-W-S-K-I, and he's at the Glenn Research Center up in Cleveland.
Okay. I know Harley real well. Yeah, I'll know Harley real well, so I'll see if he can't help me get him on the show as well.
He'd be a great guest because he did a phone presentation. FISO was one of the best presentations I've ever heard because usually there's a lot of hemming and hawing, a lot of interruptions and so forth. But he really hit the mark, and he did an entire presentation in about an hour, just flawless and just really, really informative.
Okay. Anything else, Jerry?
Just the Z-pinch question. Do you know anything about the work that's being done with the secondhand Z-pinch reactor that the NASA's got and is installing down in Huntsville?
There are some NASA folks involved in that, and it's also being worked on at the University of Alabama here in Huntsville. And I do know a little bit about it from our office. Thankfully, has been asked to participate in that and help do the ship design around the propulsion element. But that's a fusion system, and that's one of those that that might actually take us there some days. And there are lots of different ways to look at how you can creatively get beyond the break-even problem that, that fusion rockets have. And the Z-Pinch looks like one that, that really needs to be investigated further. It's got some promise. I don't know enough about it that I could give you a tutorial on how it works. Sorry. But I do know that Jason Casabri, I believe, at the university here, and fellow I work with, Dr. Rob Adams, who also are involved in that here at Marshall. And there's a lot of potential for that. Fusion is one of those, like I say, it's one of those bets that if I had to say in 150 years, what are we going to be doing, it would be high on my list. I think we're going to have so much interest in solving the fusion problem for energy production that the applications and benefits for deep space exploration will be a delta from that and come pretty cheaply once it's commercially viable, if it ever gets to that point. So, yeah, I'm a big advocate of fusion research.
Okay. Jerry?
Yeah.
That
just,
it?
Just to say, Linda, our solar system, it's not just that the stars are so far away. It's that our solar system is so big. If we ever wanted to send a probe to the Oort cloud to see what the objects are like out there, you need a fission fragment or a fusion engine to do that.
Wow. The Oort cloud, right? That goes all the way out to about one astronomical.
One AU. Or one light year.
Light years. And I meant one light year. I didn't mean one AU. I'm sorry, I misspoke. One light year. Yeah, I think you're going to have something beyond fission, just plain old fission, to do that.
That's a fission fragment.
A quarter of a way to another star, so we're talking about a long way out. So, yeah, I do. I think we're looking at fission fragment, if it has those ultimate limits in its speed, or fusion. Again, in the near term, for a robotic probe, my bets are on solar sails, because I think they're going to be a lot less expensive to develop and develop to the scale that would be required for these really deep space missions. And so I think for small payloads, which is what you're limited to with light pressure, because light pressure is so small, that's what you'll do first. And so if someone were to tell me to go lay out a plan for going to the Oort cloud in 100 years and we had to incrementally develop the technology to get there, I would do it with a solar sail. If you're talking about with people, though, I would definitely go the fusion route until we solve some antimatter production and storage problems.
Well, thank you very much. It was great talking to you, and it's a good show. Thank you,
Jerry. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Let's do sci-fi authors, or at least those in your book, have a preferred method of propulsion for their stories?
Well, you know, the authors, a few of them were a little bit skeptical about this collection. And the reason they were skeptical is they were saying, man, if we're limited to less than light speed, you know, can we, you know, isn't that just going to mean that you know, we're limited in our options for what can happen? And of course, once they got their creative minds flowing, all sorts of things happened. Who would have thought the Dalai Lama could be the subject of a story for a mission to another star? But it's a great story that's in there.
He probably came from another star system.
I don't know. There didn't seem to be a preferred option. I think antimatter seems to be the one that really captures imagination more than these others. I think that the size of the sails that would be required to send people, which are solar sails the size of the state of Texas, are just so unimaginable that they don't translate well to a fantastic story as easily as and as easy to describe as might be something that stores, you know, hundreds or thousands of kilograms of antimatter. And the whole notion of this exotic stuff in nature that when it hits matter, it annihilates and turns into pure energy is so much more just kind of viscerally exciting that they probably tend to want to go more in that direction, or fusion, than they did the solar sail or other routes. So, yeah, I would say antimatter. Now that I've talked myself into it, that's probably the one that is probably the most attractive to writers of speculative fiction in general.
Do you think the artistic license that not just the stories in your book take, but in general in science fiction, do they stay within the laws of physics, or do they really sort of just trounce on the laws of physics and anything goes?
Well, It depends. You know, even in this collection, which I, as a physicist, I've constrained them to stay within the known laws of physics, but I have a short story in the book where I have people in hibernation. Well, I have biologist friends who would say that might be as much of a stretch in biology to hibernate for hundreds of years as it is to postulate a faster-than-light drive.
Right.
And so I think we all have our crutch in speculative fiction that you have to kind of do a willing suspension of disbelief on the engineering aspects of it in order to have a good story. And you know, by nature, science fiction is often postulating things that we don't have yet. So I think it's okay for people to do that. You just have to, in my opinion, if you're trying to convey that this is a plausible story, you got to be careful in how much you do it and how you do it.
I did a show several months ago with Homer Hickam on his new book. I don't know if you've read it, about a sort of an orphan kid or something on the moon. And one of the things that Homer said he did, and it's a sci-fi story, is he had the characters actually solve the problems of living on the moon and having a settlement and having a real life on the moon. So in the process of telling the story, which was pretty science fiction oriented, they had the means and the solutions of how they actually accomplished this, whereas we don't know how to do it in real time. I thought that was a novel approach. I don't know if you've read his latest book or not, or if you've ever met him. I think he is in Huntsville, right?
Yeah, I have met him, but I haven't read his latest book. I've read a couple of his books, but I haven't read that one. But, you know, that kind of makes me think of Heinlein, right? Heinlein is the guy who postulated not just that we're going to be on the moon living there and give you a hint of the technologies that are there, but he's talking about what the politics will be and all these other things. So, you know, that's great. That's, to me, that's what draws me in.
I actually think the politics and the funding are far more powerful issues and challenges than the engineering and science and technology. And I think getting beyond the politics and the funding hurdles, even if you're looking for private funding, because you need to be able to show some returns or something in this research, those are far bigger challenges than trying to figure out, you know, the next step in engineering or science. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, that's one. You hit upon a very, very good point in that I work with and know a lot of people who think that the only challenges are technical and that the best technical solution will get funded.
And not anymore, yeah.
I had a mentor early in my career who basically said a project is not sold. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense.
Uh-huh.
Committed, funded, all this. It is not sold until you're through and you're analyzing the data. And that even if you get selected to go fly a project, there are so many things you have to do, not only technically, but you have to make sure that your cost is within the realm of what is affordable, you don't overrun, you maintain your constituency, you keep them informed of what you're doing, all the way up through when it's over. Because there have been a lot of projects, both commercial, government, NASA, military, whatever, that get started and get canceled, right?
Right.
And so it's really not sold until you're through. And in order to make it go and do that, you've got to have people who are good technically, or you don't get off the ground literally.
Right.
But you also have to have the people that can articulate the why you're doing it and can make sure that the people who are funding it and making the decisions continue to believe it's worthwhile to do.
Absolutely. You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, this is John, Atlanta.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, first off, earlier on there was a discussion of the idea of using wormholes. And one point on that is, in addition to the actual problems theoretically with it, is just the fact that the nearest wormhole isn't anywhere around here. It would be some black hole way out in interstellar space, far from our solar system, so even getting to the thing would make it not a very practical technique.
Yeah, that's right, and unless, of course, that when you understand these wormholes, you figure out how to generate an artificial wormhole, right?
Yeah.
And then you just keep piling them one miracle on top of the next.
Well, Voyager did that. Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah. And of course, we had the whole Stargate series, which is built around that.
Right.
generate your own. Well, but again, that gets into the whole issue of the fact that gravity is a very hard to control thing, unlike electromagnetism. I mean, it has this very weak coupling constant, and it seems just to be based on mass, and neither one of those things are very easy to manipulate. And they're, you know, so I think that's a, kind of the big problem with that whole idea, you know.
Well, and a civilization that learns how to manipulate gravity on these scales is going to be the civilization that settles the galaxy. And so you're right. I mean, if somebody gets to the point where they can actually take something like these theoretical ideas behind making a wormhole, if they exist, and actually do it, then they have an ability to manipulate matter in their solar system, which is going to require all sorts of other technologies that we can't even imagine right now.
So Les, if that is true, and for those out there that believe ET is around and advanced and all of that, wouldn't there be some signs in all of our studies of the galaxies and stars and Kepler and all of this where there was some manipulation going on of a star system or a planet, or would we just be unable to detect it?
Well, and you're playing right into what I have proposed to Bayan to be the subject of my next anthology, which is the Fermi paradox, right?
Okay.
Get some stories in there to talk about, you know, what some plausible things might be and some real essays. I'm with you. I wrote an essay for Bayan, which appeared on their website 2 months ago. They have a really nice website that they give away some older science fiction books. You can get a webscription service and read some really good books if you have an e-reader. And they also try to publish a science essay every month, a popular science essay on their website, and give it away. And I was asked to write one on the topic of where are they, and I chose to focus on why I don't believe we're being visited now. And this is where I stir up a whole hornet's nest of listeners who think that you know, aliens are among us. But I just think it's totally implausible to assume that within a few hundred years of us, or 50 years of us going into space, that all of a sudden we're being visited by people in spaceships that look vaguely like what we would imagine a spaceship would look like. Given the distances involved and the energy required to cover that distance, to me, if there's been an alien species to ever visit the Earth, it's far more likely they were here at the time of the dinosaurs than it would be that they're here now.
Why is that?
Well, because we've only been around for, what, 100,000 years? And the dinosaurs were around for 100 million? And just in the lifetime of the planet and distances involved in traveling through space, the likelihood of a civilization arising that has a technology to travel to the stars that we would recognize as a technology to travel to the stars coming just at the moment that we enter the space age, to me, it defies all the laws of probability.
Yeah, I think they've taken over Washington, D.C.
Now, I'm not going to say that there's no ET out there. I'd be foolish for saying.
Mars attacks may have more legitimacy to it than just a film.
But I would recommend people read my essay. It's called The Aliens Are Not Among Us. And rather than call in and blast me for that, maybe they can write me an email or something, and I'll be glad to respond.
The aliens are not among us.
The aliens are not among us, is what I contend.
And we can find that with just a simple Google search, I assume.
You ought to be able to. If you combine that in quotes with Bayan, B-A-E-N, it'll pop up on their website. But that doesn't mean that I don't believe there's not life out there. If you just look at what we understand about the development of life on Earth and everything and all these planets we're finding, I would be stunned if there was no other life out there. I would be profoundly stunned and disappointed if we were it. But is there another technological civilization that has within its window of communication something that we would understand as communication that's trying to communicate with us right now? Well, apparently not, or we would have seen them, right?
Well, not unless you're talking to one of the SETI folks.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they have a plausible rationale for not having, you know, found them yet. I mean, and they can actually only listen to such a tiny part of the solar system that everything is basically on the table, I guess.
Well, that may be. We haven't listened in the right place. And it could also be they're communicated on, you know, some other technology that we haven't envisioned yet, but that gets back to my point of it's not a technology that we would recognize. And so you're right. But if it is possible to go to the stars, and going back to where the whole Fermi paradox came from, if it is possible, and it's possible to take those steps on the scale of the lifetime of a civilization, you know, then we ought to be able to do that. We ought to be able to go to the stars. Maybe we're going to be the elder race. You know, maybe we'll start that colonization of the galaxy someday. But it's not going to happen quickly.
John, anything else from you?
Oh, yeah. One thing about the discussion of antimatter was thrown out there a little bit earlier, and I think antimatter, you know, is two problems I see with that is one is storing the kind of quantities of antimatter you'd need to really power interstellar spaceships. Seems to me to be something that's almost insurmountable. I mean, you're talking tons and tons of the stuff, and it would react with whatever, you know, you're confining it with in the most explosive and radioactive manner imaginable. Small quantities as a kind of a catalyst for things like fusion that's been discussed, or fission, either one. That I think, the much more likely use of antimatter, but to store literally hundreds of tons of the stuff to power an interstellar spaceship seems dubious.
You know, I would agree with you, except that, you know, that's an engineering problem that we cannot imagine solving today. The point of mentioning it as a possibility for going to the stars is only on the basis of physics says, you know, it's possible. Is it practical? Maybe never. But we don't know. And in terms of antimatter, today, if you were to capture all the antimatter produced in all the particle accelerators in the world, it would be on the order of a few nanograms. And you're absolutely correct. To go to the stars is going to take hundreds, if not thousands, of kilograms. You go from lots of zeros on the left side of the decimal to lots on the right side, and that's a huge jump. And the safety issues, you have to store it so that it's in a near complete or complete vacuum. You got to have charged antimatter or find a way to contain it so it doesn't touch the matter. And that's the problem with all of these interstellar propulsion options. And I mean that sincerely, is that the physics says you ought to be able to do it, but when you start looking at the incremental engineering challenges to building them, I look at it and I say, gee, I have no idea how we're going to do this. I have no idea how we're going to make this much antimatter and store it. I have no idea how I'm going to build a solar sail that has a surface area to save as the state of Alabama. I don't know how we're going to get a fusion system small enough to put it on a spacecraft as opposed to these big, you know, fusion reactors that we have today just to get fusion for a few seconds. The engineering just seems huge.
But when you defer down to fusion, I think that gets to a level that I'm much more comfortable that something like that can be developed and used, because you don't have the kind of problem that the antimatter would pose. Also, you have to generate this antimatter with far more energy, you know, than you would actually get back, which is okay for space use, but this is massive.
I agree with you. So that's what I say. If I had to place my bet in the nearer term for human level interstellar travel, it would be on fusion.
Yeah.
For robotic missions, I would still say a solar sail.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, though, if we really want to unlock really distant interstellar travel beyond going to the nearest 5 to 8 stars, then you're going to have to go and figure out how to do antimatter or how to come up with some new physics.
Yeah. Well, the early science fiction, you mentioned Heinlein, always had this idea of the mass converter, you know, where it didn't have to be antimatter. You could just convert ordinary matter into energy or almost pure energy. But, of course, baryon conservation pretty well blocks us from this. And we've done experiments up to the level of super collider, which says even if it existed, it would be at a level that would be so, it would be essentially an endothermic process rather than an exothermic process. It would take more energy to create the reaction than we'd ever get back out of it, because it has to be above the TeV levels, you know, to do it.
Yeah, that you're in an area I haven't even looked into. I don't know much about
that. Well, that is a hypothetical, that some level of energy baryon conservation would break down, because there is a net amount of matter in the universe, apparently, rather than equal matter, antimatter. So at the Big Bang level, apparently it does break under some conditions, but it's so much more energetic than anything we could practically use in a spacecraft engine that it wouldn't be too useful to us. And I think that's the problem there. So I get back to fusion as being probably our ultimate source unless there's an entirely new paradigm of science that we just can't imagine today, you know.
That's right. But there is one thing that we have not talked about, and it's one that we don't want to leave off the table that actually is not really the subject of anything in the book, is the Orion concept, the idea that you build these, you know, battleship-sized spacecraft and you detonate small nuclear weapons under it to give it an impulse to move, that Freeman Dyson and folks, really smart folks,
developed. So that's like Brilliant Pebbles, right?
I don't know if it's the same as Brilliant Pebbles. I always think of that as like an interceptor for ballistic missiles. Or
pretty extreme fission fragment, you might call it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And the neat thing about that is that if we I'm going to, you know, kind of sound like FedEx here. You know, if you absolutely had to get to the stars overnight and you had to do it, you had to go now, and somebody were to come in to me and say, Les, we've got 50 years, the solar system's going to be destroyed, we've got to send the human genome to the stars, to the nearest star, how would you do that? None of the ideas I've talked about here would be on the table. I would say, okay, let's build an Orion. And of course, when we built the Orion, we would end up destroying, you know, a big part of the environment with it, because we'd be detonating a whole bunch of nuclear weapons under it as we launched it into space. But, you know, that aside, if the whole planet's going to be wiped out anyway, what's the ecosystem, right? But, you know, we could do that. That's the kind of thing that I think Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle wrote about in their great science fiction book, Footfall, where they actually, to fight the alien invasion, of course, they used a ship powered by Orion concept, which is exploding these bombs under it, to go. And it's not something that I would ever advocate doing, because it's just reckless to do something like that, because it would be disastrous for the environment. But, you know, we can't rule it out as a way to go sometime if we had to, which is to do that. So, yeah, it needs to be on the table, too. But that would only be good for the nearest star. That wouldn't go very far beyond that.
Well, if you could find some way to generate the nuclear reactions without having all the casing of conventional bombs and still get the result, that could be useful. Some kind of a laser detonated fusion pellet system or something like that, maybe a little bit smaller scale would get.
Yeah, people have looked at that, and it may be that there'll be some creative solution to come up for that. That's right. That's always possible. It's neat to think about.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you get on with the discussion with somebody else then. It's a lot of fun talking about these things.
Thanks, John.
Okay.
Bye.
Les, we're an hour into the show. How about we take a break? We're a little bit overdue.
Sounds good.
All right. Everybody stay where you are, and we'll be back to Alpha Centauri in 3 minutes. That's going to be real quick. I will tell you how we did it when we come back. Don't go anyplace.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody. We're in part two talking to our guest today, Les Johnson. We're talking about his book, Going Interstellar, Build Starships Now. And we're talking about plausible physics and real physics and all sorts of things. And caller Marshall from Dallas is on the line with us. Hi, Marshall. Good to talk to you again. Marshall, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear you. Go ahead with your question or comment for our guest.
Okay. The ITR is the nuclear fission program in France. Sometime after 2015, they should be able to demonstrate a good power generating from fusion reactor. You've already said that you think the tokamaks could actually go a few percent of the speed of light. What would you like to see out of the ITER experiment that will convince you that it actually could be used for a 4 or 5% of light speed type engine?
Well, I guess, you know, that's a good question of what do we need to do first to enable fusion drive, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the first thing we've got to do is be able to show that you can actually get beyond break-even. Break-even is the point where you get as much energy out as you put in to cause the fusion reaction to happen. A lot of people think that we've never done fusion. We have. We've done it in the laboratory. It's understood. But the problem is to get it to go today, we take a lot more energy in than we get out of it. And places like ITER and the National Ignition Facility and others are working on ways to try to get to this beyond break-even where you can actually start getting more power out, which is what you're going to need to do to create a viable commercial power industry based on fusion. So that would be first, is to show that we know how to get more out than we put in. But unfortunately for spaceflight, you have to go way beyond that. You have to get it small. And you have to be able to have the, even if you can get more power out than you put in, if it takes gigawatts to get it started and then it's totally self-sustaining, you know, where in space on a spaceship are you going to get that kind of power to get it to go? So the next step beyond just showing that you can get break-even has to be, is there a path to making it small enough and compact enough and still have more energy out than put in to make it viable to put on a spacecraft? Do I think that's possible? Nature hasn't said it's impossible, so yeah, I think it's possible. Do I know how to engineer that? No, I don't. But I think things like the ITER and the National Ignition Facility and those places are doing the right thing. And that's an essential first step toward getting there. But I am bullish on fusion. I think it will ultimately be something that's on the table for taking us. And if your listeners are interested in the latest on fusion propulsion and how it might be used for star travel, they need to go visit Icarus Interstellar. This is a project that is looking, it's mostly volunteer project of engineers around the world who are actually doing a concept design for a fusion-powered interstellar spacecraft.
Yeah, we've had them on the show before, along with Tau Zero and their entire group, and Richard has been on the show a couple of times, and they'll continue to be on the show. But let me interrupt Marshall and you, because I do every year a couple of shows with the alternative small guys in fusion. You know, like Eric Lerner, for example, Focus Fusion, Lawrenceville Plasma, you know, people using boron and other kinds of things, quite the opposite of what the ITER is doing, and obviously for a song and a dance in terms of the cost as compared to the billions that are going into, you know, the big fusion research. Do you see any... I get reports from these guys, and it looks like they're making real progress. Do you follow any of this? Do you think they are? I mean, the Navy's been involved in it with Dr. Broussard's technology. Is there hope in this area of fusion research?
I have to admit my ignorance. I don't know.
Okay.
I wish I did, and you just told me something I'm going to be looking up in the next few days, because I really just don't know anything about it.
Well, go check out Focus Fusion and Eric Lerner and Lawrenceville Plasma and Dr. Robert Broussard. He's, of course, passed away, but the Navy got a hold of all of his work and has been doing fusion things. And I've tried to get some of them on the show, even people who are no longer involved with the Navy groups doing it, and they won't talk. I think it's Broussard. Is that right, Marshall?
You're asking the world's worst speller.
All right. Well, anyway, I just keep hearing that these alternative guys with boron and their approach is vastly different than the ITER, and that they keep moving forward with progress. Of course, they're always financially starved, like everybody and everything, and not just infusion, across the board. We all need more money. And, if I believe all the press, Les, this is making faster progress than anything in the big fusion world.
Well, that just means I'm going to have to get off here and
well,
I don't want to be ignorant of something making that much progress toward making this a reality. I've got to get smart on it.
If you find out anything about it or have any conclusions or anything, I'd love to hear from you about it. I either hear from the people who believe in the big fusion world or people in the boron world. And never in between. So I don't know the facts. It's not my field. I'm subject to being influenced by the last guys whose paper I've read.
Yeah, and you never can, unless you're reading the source journal article and you're an expert in the field, it's difficult to know whether you're getting the whole story. I had a discussion with the science fiction writer James Hogan, James P. Hogan, one of my favorite writers. He's now deceased. And he asked a question to me one time. He said, Les, how often when you read a popular account of something going on in the space field, do they get it all correct? And my answer was, well, I don't know that I've ever read an article where they've gotten it all correct. And he said, well, what makes you think in about fields that you're not an expert in that they get it all correct? And at that moment, I realized, oh, my, I had been placing too much faith in well-intentioned and not-so-well-intentioned, science writers who do their best to make it correct. But you just always have to be discerning, and it's tough to know really where it is unless you go to the source of the scientific paper and it's been through a peer-reviewed journal, and not many of us are qualified to do that. So it is hard to know.
Marshall, anything? You know all the alternative guys. You've heard those shows.
Oh, yes, I have.
Do you think, are they crackpots, or are they on to something?
Well, it's sort of like IDER. Until you can set up and demonstrate something that absolutely works, you can't improve on it, right? So if you can't demonstrate the basic concepts, because a lot of times we get basic concepts and, yeah, we can fuse helium-3 and get out energy, but that doesn't mean that we can do anything useful, right? So any of these concepts require that you produce a demonstration system. From that, you engineer the replacement system, the second generation, third generation. And it is usually isn't until the third or fourth generation you actually have something that's useful. And ITER is basically a second generation. I think ITER will show us something interesting, but it's not going to be the fusion system that replaces all the nuclear power stations in the United States. It won't do that. It's still a prototype. And then you have to come in there and say, well, to put it into space and make a interstellar space drive out of it, you have to come in there and we're probably going to have three or four generations, three or four completely from scratch designs, because you're going to learn so much from this first one. And then that kind of leads me back to the follow-up question, and that is, which one of the fuels do you think is going to be the winner? Is it going to be boron, or is it going to be helium-3, maybe helium-2, or maybe it's going to be hydrogen?
Well, I guess about the only one that I don't think is going to be is just plain hydrogen-hydrogen fusion, because I think that's going to be just too hard. The sun requires the mass of the sun to make that work. As far as the others, I really don't know. I couldn't even give an educated.
What about thorium? Does it enter into the picture?
You talk about for fission reactors?
Fusion.
Now, I don't know about thorium and fusion. I know a little bit about thorium for fission.
Well, I know it's a possibility for fission, but
yeah, but I don't know about fusion. Don't know anything about that.
I don't think there is a possibility of thorium fusion at all. Anyway. Enjoyed it. I'll let the next person talk.
Thank you, Marshall. Marshall said it depends on you know, what these guys can show and produce. So just as sort of an aside, I get on average 8 to 10 emails and sometimes phone calls a week from people who know about the space show, and they want to be guests on the show, and they've created the theory of everything, or the best book that solves all the anti-gravity problems, or it, you name it. I mean, let your mind run wild, except they're not representing themselves to be science fiction. They're representing themselves to be the real McCoy, even if it's a self-published book that they don't know the first rules of grammar or spelling in the book, for example. So after they give me their song and dance, which hopefully doesn't take up too much of my time because I do respond to everybody's emails and all that, they always say, so what do you think? What do you think? And I say, here's what I think. I think you're full of it. And if you really believe in yourself, go out and make it happen and then contact me again. Because all I hear from people is they've got the theory of everything. They've got the best this. They've got it all worked out. They've got this. And nothing ever happens. You guys never produce a thing. You never fly a thing. You never make a rocket. It's so much rhetoric and so much talk, you know, and you're asking me to put you on the air, and you can't make anything happen. So contact me when you make something happen, and then I'll be happy to talk to you. And, of course, that doesn't go over well, but they don't make anything happen. And I think that's probably a problem within the space industry. There's absolutely no shortage of creativity, even creativity that comes in a Kellogg's Kool-Aid box. But, man, people really buy into it and believe it, but they can't produce and make anything work. I've never seen anything like it, Les. It's not science fiction to them. They're not saying they're writing science fiction. They think they've got the answers, and yet nobody can make anything work, and they have rationalization after rationalization for that. So I don't know, maybe space is unique in that field, and maybe it's not, but 8 to 10 times a week I go through this, all the time.
Well, I'm glad you gave your answer to it rather than me. I don't do it that frequently, but I do get stuff like that across my desk at work and sometimes in email. And the best answer is, if you've got a really good idea, then there are ways to get it reviewed and go through the process of having critical minds look at it and see if there's something there or not. And I don't believe that there's some vast conspiracy to squash good ideas that'll take us to the stars.
If
you really come up with something, then you can get it published, you can get it reviewed, and if it's really there, there's going to be no shortage of people to advocate for it.
John Hunt sent in Dr. Robert Bussard's actual spelling, which is Bussard, and his fusion concept is called the Polywell fusion. And that's the one that the Navy and others were working on. And he was a legend in advanced propulsion, going back early on with his work on nuclear thermal in the 50s. And he has the concept of the Bussard fusion ramjet concept.
Now, I am familiar with the Bussard ramjet.
Yeah, well, that's him. And I was very fortunate to have him on the show, and he passed away about 6 months after that. I believe he was very ill with lung cancer or something like that, and one of his followers or disciples or aides was doing a show, and he called in, and we got to talk to him for 30 or 40 minutes, and it was a real honor. And maybe there's something to all of his ideas and work, but it sure is tightly controlled, and, you know, like everything else, you're waiting for the results.
And there's a in technology advancement, unfortunately, there is a problem in that some of these ideas can go really rapidly from idea to prototype to flight, but other things require an infrastructure that is so huge and so expensive just to take it to the next step that it takes a big commitment and a lot of resources to go. And unfortunately, I think in the space business, a lot of what we do is of that kind. And so even if you do have a good idea that's plausible, you know, getting the resources, i.e. the money, you know, to take it to that next step is really hard to do.
Absolutely. During the break, you mentioned that you have a couple of more books in the works. You want to give us a preview of what's in store from your pen?
Sure. Yeah, pen to phosphor, I think, is where we've gone. Electrons to phosphor and now to LCD, right?
All right.
Yeah, I have a science fiction novel that I wrote about 2 years ago with Travis Taylor, who's another established science fiction writer, called Back to the Moon. That was released also by Bayon and hardcover, and then again in this past January in paperback. And it's about what a realistic 2020-something return to the moon might be like in this day and age of private space flight and China's rise and all that. But the exciting thing for me is that we were offered a sequel to that. So Travis and I are going to be writing a sequel to that book. It's as yet untitled, and that'll be out in just a couple of years because we're not far enough along on that. I have a popular science book that I'm writing now for Springer Books that deals with, I can talk a little bit about it, I guess, deals with what would happen and the impact on the economy and such if we were to lose our satellites from whatever cause. So what a lot of people don't realize, and I'd love to come back and talk about this when the book's finished, it's not finished yet, is, you know, the impact it would have on our economy and on our lives if we no longer had satellites. And it could be pretty dramatic. So those are the two nearer-term books that I'm working on. One's a popular science book, and one's a science fiction book. And so, yeah, it's fun. I like talking to people about space and space science, and being an author has been a rewarding thing to do. It's opened up a lot of doors and let me meet some interesting people and hopefully help get the word out about how important space is.
Listeners, our line is still available, 1-866-687-7223. In your book, Going Interstellar, you have a Michael Bishop story with this humongous starship called Kalachakra, I think, if I'm pronouncing it right, that has nearly 1,000 people on it going to the Jalisco 581 system. What would be involved technically if you really had a starship with 1,000 people on board? I mean, that just seems so mammoth for anything we know of in space.
Well, and I think that's what, pardon my bluntness here, we're going to have to get over this idea that space has to be done in small increments. Any of these spaceships that take us to the stars, let me just go back and set the stage. Even a small robotic probe, if we want to send something like Voyager to another star, it's going to be a massive undertaking in and of itself, even for a small spacecraft. To send Voyager using a solar sail is going to require a sail that has the size of the state of Alabama. That's huge. And to build an antimatter starship that has the resources for carrying people and a civilization, we're going to be thinking just truly enormous scale engineering. So I don't envision this kind of undertaking until we become a truly spacefaring civilization, where we're not building these things on the Earth and launching them to orbit in little rockets. This is going to be undertaken when we actually have industries in space. We're mining the asteroids. We have a base on the moon. We've got multiple space stations. We're sending people and probes to the outer solar system. That's when we're going to have the capability to start engineering some of these ships to take us to the stars. And even then, a ship with 1,000 people is going to be a big undertaking. But it won't seem as large an undertaking as it does to us today, because basically it would be like us today trying to figure out how to build one of these big cruise ships when the biggest thing we've ever built is a canoe. Okay?
Right.
And so I think we just have to set ourselves in a future where space development is happening, we've got space solar power satellites, we're doing all these other things, and then we start thinking about how to build one of these big interstellar craft. Then it may not seem like such a big leap.
Well, maybe the aliens will show up by then and tell us how it's done.
I wouldn't put my money on that.
You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please?
Hi, my name is Lorraine Glenn, and I'm in Atlanta, Georgia.
Hi. Lorraine.
I wasn't sure you'd recognize my full name, Les.
Of course. Good to hear you.
Well, good to hear you, too. I saw your notice up that you were going to be on, and so I tuned in, and I've been waiting for the phone number to actually be mentioned again so I could call in. Dr. Livingston, I'm a long-term friend of Les's. Let me put it that way. So let me get it out there right away so everybody knows. I am a very, very big fan of his, and I love all of his books, and he has done me the favor a number of times of coming and speaking. I actually run a space track at a local convention, and Les comes and speaks on my track every year. So I wanted to get that out there. And my big question I wanted to put out there is to give Les a chance to tell all of the other people out there where they might be able to come and actually listen to him live. I know you've got a convention that you're doing later on this month, I believe, that people can come and listen to you at, too.
Well, that's right. I try to go to I got to be a fan of space for two reasons. One is I was a seven-year-old boy when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, so now the secret's out. I'm 50 this year. and also, I was able to read science fiction, and so I owe a lot to science fiction. That's one of the reasons I went into physics and did what I did. It was my motivation and my inspiration. And so I owe a bit of gratitude to science fictiondom. And so I go to science fiction conventions maybe four times a year. And I'll be at LibertyCon, which is a small convention in Chattanooga, about 500 people, that is in two weekends, not this next weekend, but two weekends out. And it's a great convention. If you're in the Chattanooga, Tennessee area, I encourage you to go to this. It's going to have some great folks there. Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle will be there, among many others. Tim Zahn, just kind of a who's who of science fiction, will be at this little convention.
Let me put it out there, Les is the guest of honor for their science.
Yeah, I've been asked to be their science guest of honor this year, which is, for this group of folks, it's like your friends honoring you, which is always very meaningful. It's great, and I love that little convention. But a big one is Rain's convention, the Dragon Con, which is going to be Labor Day weekend in Atlanta. And that's not for the faint-hearted. I mean, there'll be 30,000 people there in one
year. Let me correct you right there. We had 50,000 last year.
Oh, man, bigger than I thought. But Rain is running the space track for that, and there are hundreds of people who come for that, and it's a great weekend of scientists and space scientists, and there's a science fiction track also, and all sorts of things. But it's a great weekend. If you're going to be in Atlanta, I encourage you to come to downtown Labor Day weekend, come to the Dragon Con, and just geek out with all your fellow space friends. It's a great weekend for that.
And it's a wonderful chance for all of you who have enjoyed listening to any interviews that Les has done. He usually does at least two or three different talks, either singly or actually this year he will have one of his co-authors who will be there with him.
Yeah, Greg Matloff will be there for his first DragonCon this year. And Greg and I co-authored three popular science books together, and he contributed an essay for Going Interstellar.
If you enjoy listening to Les just in a regular interview, listening to him live is phenomenal.
Well, I appreciate that, Rain, but everybody needs to know I did not twist her arm to call in.
Rain, what is the website?
I did this on my own because I want to tell people. It is so much fun listening to him. It's amazing the amount of information that he has in his head and the different things that he can talk about. And the fact that listening to him and talking to him, he's very honest about everything. You know, you've listened to him already, he'll tell you outright, you know, this is something I'm interested in, but maybe I don't know everything about it. And you know, so you don't feel like you're getting BS'd by some scientist.
What is the website for DragonCon?
The website for DragonCon is www.dragoncon.org.
Okay.
But, you know, Les does other cons during the year, and that's really why I called it. I want people to have the opportunity to find out the different places that they can go listen to him and actually hear him speak, because he is, you know this, Les, you are one of my absolute favorite people in the world, and you and your wife and your family, and I always look forward to having him. He's one of the first people I check on every year to find out whether he's going to be coming back to my convention.
Well, thanks, Ryan. You're very kind. I like to get out and do these things. I go about four times a year, mostly in the Southeast. You can probably find a science fiction convention happening in every city of the country just about, you know, every weekend of the year. There's something near you.
And we just had SETICON, too, out here in Santa Clara, which I would have attended had I not been in Florida at the same time.
Yeah, I actually wanted to go to that as well, but I had a friend who was getting married that weekend. So.
And then they have the sci-fi conferences here where everybody comes in costume as their favorite science fiction character or something. I think that's a little bit different, but
no, that the DragonCon does that.
Yeah,
oh,
but
they
I
do
don't
that.
Come dressed up.
You don't.
I don't wear pointy ears when I go to the.
You don't come as a NASA engineer.
not typically. not with a pocket protector anyway. But I do enjoy them. The folks who dress up, you know, one of the things I need to always point out when I talk about science fiction conventions because a lot of serious scientists and engineers will kind of raise their eyebrows at these things. They shouldn't, because these conventions are populated by some of the brightest, most engaged members of the science-literate and science-interested public that you will find anywhere.
Absolutely.
And it's wonderful to talk to them. They write their congressmen. They are the ones that are hungry for what's really going on. And there are a large number of science teachers. One of the things I've found is when I ask in an audience of how many people here are teachers, I get lots of hands come up and a lot of science teachers. And so it's wonderful to be able to engage with those folks. And, yeah, a lot of them wear pointy ears on the weekend. That's great. They're having fun.
Les, let me interject this as well. This is something that you and I have brought up, and I know you're talking about your book, Interstellar, Going Interstellar. There is an educational side to that book, is there not?
Oh, that's right. Thank you for the prompt. That's right. Our publisher likes to do two things. Bain Books gives a lot of books to the military and sends books to active duty service personnel as one of their community service activities. And what they also do is for some selected books, they actually commission and hire someone to do a teacher's guide. And there is a teacher's guide for Going Interstellar, which is for high school kids, and it's available free from the Bayon website. You'd have to search for it. It's linked where my book is on there. You can get it in PDF, and it's an attempt to tie in the literature and the high school level science curricula together so that perhaps the book can be read and the stories can be talked about from their literary aspects. Because remember, some of these authors are award-winning authors, Hugo and Nebula award-winning science fiction writers. And then combine that with the science curriculum, talking about some of the physics concepts that are there. And they've done a teacher's guide. And it's available for free from the Bayon website for download.
And that is something that we always try and focus. And I think probably most science fiction conventions these days try and do that, is to focus on the aspects of science education, in the schools. I know Les has helped me out with this in the past before. I always try and keep a freebie table in the back of my room with educational materials that I try and get my guests to bring to me. And I've had letters afterwards from teachers and parents telling me, especially in these days where there's so many budgetary cuts in schools, that the information and the materials that they pick up off of my table are sometimes the only things that they have to teach with. They take, whatever packets and something that they can get, and, besides the one chapter that might be in the science book that they have, and they use that material overall to help teach, what little science education and space education that they are able to in schools these days. And I think myself and I know some of the other directors, at Dragon Con, and I believe in most science fiction conventions, that is a huge push that we all want to do, which is another reason why we love having, people like Les there, because it encourages especially the parents or the soon-to-be parents that might be in the audience to go back and push that same type of information into their kids, because maybe they're not getting it in schools these days.
Well, they're definitely not getting it in school from what I can tell out here. So, Les, do you have a website that has your travel and appearance schedule on it?
Well, actually, I need to do a consolidated one for that. There are two things people can look. One is they can check out my author page on Amazon. And so just search for Les Johnson, and there are several Les Johnsons, but you'll tell my books from the other guy, because the other guy's an expert on fishing, and it'll have books on fly fishing. So that's not me. Go to the ones that are space and science fiction, and I have my convention appearances on there, and I need to update it, Rain, because I haven't put Dragon Con. I try to do things within the next 3 months, and I've been remiss. I've traveled so much for NASA, I haven't put it on there. And then my website that I maintain is, of course, www.lesjohnsonauthor.com. And it's on there that you can find information about my books and some of my past speaking appearances, and I try to list my upcoming events there also, but I have to admit I'm a little remiss on getting it updated. It's been a busy summer for me. In addition to the ISU, I traveled my first trip ever to the European Space Technology Center for NASA, which is over in the Netherlands. I was over there for a solar sail planning meeting, which
and
is one of the technologies.
If Les hasn't mentioned it, Les actually holds some patents in solar sail.
Okay.
So, yeah, solar sails are kind of my passion for propulsion. or advanced propulsion, they and space tethers, which are, I think we've talked about that before, David. You know, there's got to be different ways that we can use the environment of space for propulsion, and those are two of the, on my professional, wearing my NASA hat side, that I'm a big advocate for within the agency is continued solar sail research as well as advanced propulsion using tethers and such. Those are two of my favorites. But so, yeah, I've been traveling a lot, so I'm a little bit behind on keeping that stuff up.
Okay.
No, that's okay. Les, I didn't realize that you had a sequel, that you'd been granted the sequel to Back to the Moon. So
We have.
I'm excited about that.
Yeah, Travis and I signed a contract for that. Now we've got to write it.
Well, yeah, there's that, too. There's that, too. And I'm looking forward to the new Springer book, too. In fact, because I remember you and I actually having a conversation about this at the Alabama book, what was that?
Alabama Book Festival.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it took a while to get that one going, but it is, and I'm behind. It's supposed to be delivered actually about 3 weeks ago, and I'm hoping to have it before another 3 weeks passes. I'll definitely have it delivered before DragonCon.
So we'll have it before Fusion, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, you know, I will let the phone go and let other people actually have a chance to talk to Les, but I wanted to call in and let him know that I was listening and give other people a chance to know where they can actually hear him talk in person.
Thank you very much, Rain.
Thank you.
Okay.
See you soon, Les.
Bye.
Bye.
Listeners, there's still time if any of you want to call in real quickly. Again, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. When I was at the ISU thing, the Tuesday during the day, Leonard and most of the media panel and a few people from ISU were given a very special tour of KSC on the human spaceflight side. And I've been talking about it on the air a lot because it was really impressive. And seeing the shuttle going inside Endeavour, going up on Pad 39A and seeing all of this, do you think that the labor-intensive, cost-intensive, infrastructure-intensive needed to support today's government-run human spaceflight program will be what's required in future human spaceflight 100 years from now or further down the road, or will it be so simplified and so much more like things we're familiar with that this will all just seem really archaic and historical?
Well, I think we got to be a little careful because the word, forgive me if I sound defensive, but, you know, to connect the things that NASA does to being complex and people-intensive, I think one of the things that we've learned from the shuttle is that it was complex and people-intensive. And if you want to have more affordable space transportation, whether it be something that NASA develops, and by the way, when we develop something, we do it with private industry. I mean, we have contracts.
No, I realize that everything is privately done in this country.
Yeah, or whether it's totally privately financed, whichever it is going to have learned from those, I won't call them mistakes, I'll say those lessons learned.
Yeah, lessons learned.
And I think it is bound to be simpler, absolutely, because it won't be affordable if it's not. So with automation and with a design goal of reducing the hands-on requirements between flights for reusability or rebuild, that's the only way it's going to become affordable. I mean, if we had to rebuild an airplane every time you boarded one to fly from Huntsville, Alabama to Washington, D.C., it would be horrifically expensive and you would never go. And so in order for it to be the future that I hear you talking about on your breaks, right, where you
right.
want to see it be just like going to Tahiti or taking a cruise, It's got to be that way, or it'll never happen. So I think absolutely it's going to be looked back on as a lesson learned, and thank goodness we figured out how to do it better.
Necessary, essential steps in the process of figuring it all out is this. I mean, I hear people say shuttle was a failure. We should have never done this and this and all this. And I look at it and say, you know, this is what we had to go through to be able to have a Falcon 9, for example, because they're building on the backs and shoulders of giants that have come before them. They're not reinventing the wheel, so to speak. So I see all of this as absolutely essential to how we got to where we are today and wherever we're going in the future, I don't see it as a failure or anything that so many people like to talk about. Do you concur more or less with what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree with you. But at the same time, I wish that Von Braun's plans hadn't been canceled and that we had his space station that was on the Collier's magazine cover and that
right.
we had our first trip to Mars by 1989 or 84 that he'd wanted to have.
And that rocket at Tomorrowland with TWA on it was really cool.
Yeah. So while I agree with what you're saying is that, you know, we've learned a lot from the shuttle, and the shuttle in its own right did some fantastic things. Science and the Space Lab program that a lot of people have forgotten about and learning to live and work in space and the assembly of the space station did some tremendous things. It was a complex vehicle, and these new vehicles are not going to be that complex. And you're right, they've learned from what we did on shuttle. And were there other paths we could have taken? Yeah, and I would love to have seen the path that Von Braun envisioned be the one that we would have followed. But given that we didn't, we got to make the most of what we did do, right?
Absolutely.
And try to make better decisions for the future.
You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you?
Hi, this is Terry in Corpus Christi.
Go ahead, Terry.
Les, in your Interstellar book, you talked about a solar cell project where you, to maximize miles per hour, you looped around the sun and then came back to get the majority of the light behind the cell.
Yes.
Did you project gravitational assist on the outer planets to boost the output on it?
No, not really. Because, and by the way, it's very flattering to talk to someone who's actually read the book before the show. So I'm glad you picked it up. Yeah, with a solar sail, and I think I probably need to explain this for listeners who may not be as familiar with it as you are since you've been reading it. It relies on the push of sunlight. And there's a certain amount of sun that falls on a certain area. Let's say you have a square sail of so many hundred square feet and it's in space at the Earth's distance from the sun. You get a certain push from the light reflecting off that at that distance. There's this thing called the inverse square law, which says that if you cut the distance in half, at first glance, most people would look at that and say, well, that means you get twice as much thrust. Well, yeah, you get more thrust, but what you get is you get four times as much thrust when you cut the distance in half. And if you cut it to one-fourth the distance that you started from, you get four squared as much light on it. So you get 16 times as much thrust as you got at the Earth distance. So the optimum trajectory to get a solar sail to go really fast is to deploy the sail fairly close to the sun so you get as much thrust from the sunlight reflecting from the sail as you can really close to the sun. So when you look at these interstellar missions, the trajectory that we propose is one that takes it fairly close to the sun, maybe a little bit inside Mercury's orbit, so you can really maximize the solar photon pressure on the sail to get it moving really fast. The problem with that is, to answer your question, is when you get to the big planets in the outer solar system, you're really moving really, really fast for some of these sails, and the marginal increase you would get from doing a gravity assist, if any at all, because it depends on the orbital velocity of the planet around the sun, would be small. And so, no, in our optimum trajectories, we actually say that you throw away the solar sail at about Jupiter because the sunlight pressure has dropped off a lot by then, and you just coast the rest of the way. So for the missions that are going to take you to the stars, the boost extra that you might get from a close approach at a planet is going to be not very helpful, and it might actually be too risky to do traveling at those speeds. So I wouldn't do it.
What are you figuring on your maximum speed using the system?
It depends on what generation sail it is. If it's something that we do in the next 50 years, 50 kilometers a second, which is really fast. I mean, that's what we would need to do a project called the Interstellar Probe. And that would be a sail that is probably five times bigger than what we can build today. So it can probably be built, but we haven't quite done it yet. If you're talking about a true interstellar solar sail, then you'd be talking about something that would travel at, 5% the speed of light, potentially. But you would need, a really, really big sail to do that. And you might want to put a big laser out into space to continue reflecting light from the sail after it leaves the sun's influence to keep accelerating it. So there are different approaches to doing it. So the answer to your question about how fast it would go, the limit is depends on the scenario. I mean, if you had a sail that was, you know, almost infinitely thin and highly reflective and just an atomic layer deep and the size of Texas and you had big terawatt lasers around the sun, you might be able to get to Alpha Centauri in 40 years. Do we know how to build a system like that? No. Is there a reason we can't? Does nature say that that won't work? Well, nature says it will work, but we just don't know how to engineer it.
Have you done any studies to see if you kept your solar cell when you got into the next star system to use the solar cell to deaccelerate your speed?
Yes. I will not claim that I came up with it. Dr. Robert Forward, scientist, inventor, and science fiction writer, came up with the approach of how you would use a sail to slow down when you reach the target solar system years ago. And I think I talk about that in the solar sail chapter of the book. If you want to know more about that, the book that I co-wrote with Giovanni Volpetti and Greg Matloff is called Solar Sails, A Novel Approach to Interplanetary Travel. Is a highly accessible, it's a popular science book that describes all the things you can do with solar sails, and we talk about that in more detail in that book. Or you can also Google Dr. Forward's work on the Internet and find some of his papers that are now in the public domain that he wrote years ago about how that might be done.
Is there any way to engineer on how much of a speed deceleration that you would have? How far out you would have to use that?
That depends. I mean, one way you could use a sail to do that is a solar sail where you use the reflected sunlight to slow down, but you might not be able to do that and slow down enough without a really, really close solar approach and traveling as fast as you're traveling. That would be real sporty. Another way is to use the laser and have like a two-stage sail where one part of the sail separates and you use the other part to reflect and refocus the laser light to slow it down. That's what the approach that Forward came up with. So yeah, it's doable. Personally, I think if we send a solar sail probe to another star, it's going to be a flyby mission. I don't think we'll try to slow down, at least not with the first few. So we would just go through there really quickly, have instruments to observe what's there, and then radio the data back home.
What kind of transmitter would you use to send back your data?
You just have to use radio. You could build a transmitter today that would be powerful enough to send data that we could hear back from the nearest stars. So that's not that much of a stretch. We could actually do that. It takes more power than we've put on spacecraft today, but not so much power that by the time we're able to build these big systems that we couldn't use it to broadcast back home. Now the question is, if it's a 1,000-year trip, is there anybody back home that will remember what radio is to tune in and listen? You know, it might be analogous to us, you know, being asked to go dig out our cuneiform tablets and decipher the stone engravings in a language which no longer exists. But perhaps somebody in that 1,000-year future would still be using this primitive thing called radio for communication and be able to receive the message.
Well, it was very enjoyable talking to you, and I hope you come back on the program soon, and I'll clear the line.
Yeah,
thanks,
Terry. Thank you. Appreciate
it. Thanks a lot.
We're coming up on a two-hour show, so...
I'm about to crap out here. We're getting ready to have a storm, too, which is wonderful news. We've been in a drought here.
Well, let me ask you real quick, because one of the things I thought really unique about your book that I have not come across before is the very, very creative and cool use of nursery rhymes by Sarah Hoyt. And I just didn't expect that. Are you there?
I'm here. I don't know what to say. Sarah is an author I have been wanting to work with for a long time. I read her work. I read some of her mystery novels. She is a mystery writer as well as a science fiction writer. And
uh-huh.
She had lots of hall talk. And I asked her to contribute something to this. Had no idea what she was going to come up with. And it was wonderful.
Yes, it was wonderful. And I just had not put nursery rhymes into the context of space or science fiction, and she uses it to give out clues and to teach. I mean, it's amazing.
And she's that kind of a person. Sarah is an artist, and I don't mean like a writing artist. I mean a visual artist. I mean like a writing artist. And
right.
The way she thinks, she kind of looks at things from a different direction than most of us do in the science fiction realm, and she comes up with some really neat ideas.
Well, listeners, I won't give it away, but it's a chapter called The Big Ship and the Wise Old Owl on page 367, and I guarantee you you'll enjoy it. So, Les, until the next time, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Any real quick final thoughts or concluding comments you want to share with us?
Well, only, David, I appreciate you having me on the show. It was a very quick 2 hours. And I really appreciate the thoughtful questions from the folks who are listening. As someone who likes to get out and talk about what we're doing, it's always nice to get questions from people who are listening and have really thought about some of these problems. It perhaps is one of the most daunting things that we as a human species are ever going to do, right?
Absolutely.
It's spreading out into space, and we need engaged people to keep support for that going. So thanks for having me on the show, and I want to thank your listeners for listening.
Okay, and keep in touch, and let me know for the next time, okay?
I'll sure do it. Thank you, and folks, just check out my website. And one of the things I'll be doing in the next few days is updating that, and I will put in a quick plug. We are hosting something called the Tennessee Valley Interstellar Workshop, which we had one last November in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and it's a day to geek out with some people who are thinking seriously about how we might go to the stars. And we're having another one, and it'll be in Huntsville in February of 2013. So I'll be having announcements on my website about that. And if you're in the area and would like to attend, we'll have an address that you can write off to an email to get more information.
All right, and we'll be talking to you more about that later on, too. So thanks a lot for coming back, and we'll look forward to talking to you the next time.
Thanks, David. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And listeners, that's it for today. And back again tomorrow, and watch the newsletters for our programming this week, and we will be in touch. Have a good rest of the weekend, everybody. Goodbye.